gestern bei Tetut wurde uns
einen kleinen Buch gegeben, um die eure Laborenspeicherung zu lösen für die Elektro-Design. Spontan.
So, good morning everybody. Welcome to another lecture on compact star physics. So the last time we started to discuss general relativity, we discussed the equivalence principle and redshift, which is a direct consequence of the equivalence principle. And then already discussed somehow the weak field limit of the metric, introduced the metric and the concept of time-like and space-like and light-like trajectories through space-time. Any questions about last lecture? No? Okay. So we continue today with general relativity, and we're talking a little bit about Einstein's equation. Yep. Okay, so chapter 2.3, Einstein's equation. So what we're going to do is we give just some heuristic argument how the Einstein equation has to look like. So we don't really make a full-fledged analysis or a derivation, but we discuss just the essentials so that you grasp somehow the underlying meaning of the Einstein equations for later purposes. So what is the equation in Newtonian gravity we need to solve? So on one hand, we have the gravitational potential. On the other hand, we have some mass, or we have some distribution of masses, which generates some overall gravitational potential. Okay. So we have two ingredients. We have phi, the gravitational potential, and in an and we have the mass distribution rho, and this both depends on R, basically in Newton's theory. So this is the mass distribution. Yeah, and I should write down here, this is Newton, right? So Newton, we can talk about a gravitational potential and a mass distribution. And in general relativity, we have to replace those two quantities to some more general aspects. We have seen already that somehow the acceleration is unique. So there's a unique path through space-time of the acceleration. And so we will replace actually the gravitational potential will be replaced then by the curvature of space-time. So the path just follows the shortest path through space-time. And the mass distribution we will replace then later on with the energy momentum tensor, which is a more generic description of the mass distribution, or let's say the energy distribution in the universe. Yeah, we have seen that due to the equivalence principle, GR not only couples to the masses of the particle, but also to binding energy and mass defects. So it couples to the overall energy density, which is around. So the coupling between those two is, of course, the gravitational constant, or Newton's constant, gravitational constant. And it turns out this is actually the only scale which enters in general relativity. So there's a unique scale which is associated with gravity. That's the gravitational constant. If you go to natural units, we will actually realize that a gravitational constant in natural units this means h bar is equal c is equal 1. Yeah. This gravitational constant is just has the dimension of 1 over mass squared. Yeah, so the dimension of G is just a 1 over mass squared. And actually, it turns, and you might know what that mass scale is we are talking about here. So I'm just saying that G is basically 1 over a mass squared. What kind of mass scale is this? This sets the mass scale of general relativity.
Do you mean G?
No, it's a constant of nature. The Planck mass, yes. So here the Planck mass enters. Yeah. So the Planck mass is the scale of general relativity, which is in natural units. We're talking about in units of the mass of the nucleon or in units of GeV. Does anybody know how many GeV is the Planck mass? What scale is the Planck mass?
10 to the 19.
10 to the 19 GeV. So the Planck mass is 10 to the 19 GeV. It is about 10 to 19 GeV. So this is about 10 to 19 times the mass of the nucleon. Yeah. So it's a scale which is well beyond the natural scale we have here. The natural scale we have just discovered for quantum electrodynamics is somewhere in the electron volt range. For the nuclear forces, it's in the GeV range. But this is at 10 to 19 GeV. So the most massive particle we know is the top quark, which has 170 GeV. Again, this is 17 orders of magnitude smaller. And this is the problem of basically bringing together gravity and all the other forces, because the scale of gravity is so far off than the other scales. This is also called the hierarchy problem. Right? So there's a hierarchy. We see a hierarchy of forces, and then this huge jump, and suddenly comes gravity. And this you can all read off already from the value of G of the gravitational constant, basically. Yeah? So the gravitational constant, gravity in principle is feeble. It's a really feeble force because it goes like 1 over the mass squared. Yeah? So this goes like 1 over 10 to 19 GeV squared compared to the strong scale, which is 1 over GeV squared. So there are 38 orders of magnitude weaker interactions in gravity compared to the strong interactions. Similar things holds for electromagnetism, right? And the most simple example is if you just have a magnet, yeah? So a tiny magnet can lift up something which is magnetic very easily, despite the fact that we have how much? 10 to 24 kilogram of mass, which is pulling that magnet down or that piece of iron down, but a small magnet can just lift it up. And the reason is that we have this huge differences in these interactions. Okay, now I've got distracted. So back to Newtonian potentials. So we have the Laplace equation, which describes the Newtonian gravity, how we can get the gravitational potential from the mass distribution. Yeah, so we have delta squared of phi of r is given by 4 pi g times the mass distribution rho of r. And there's a Newton's universal time, so everything just depends on r, not on time. So there are no dilatation effects, so this force is instantaneous. So it travels a course, basically, yeah, in this model. Yeah. This is the mass of the nucleon, which is 1 GeV, yeah, which sets the mass scale of strong interactions. So now if we go to GR, in GR we have different quantities now. Yeah, we have to talk about four vectors, we have to talk about tensors and Lorentz structure, so that's the first thing to do. So we have to replace this whole thing to make it really Lorentz invariant and look for the corresponding variables which can replace the gravitational potential and the mass distribution. So the characteristic quantity which describes space-time and how particles move is the metric. G menu, the metric. Yeah. So we see already that somehow we have two indices here, so we have to talk about also derivatives up to second order. To make it the Lorentz scalar plus derivatives of second order. Yeah, this makes the whole thing a Lorentz scalar. We can contract the whole thing. And also you see that here we have derivatives of second order. Yeah, so this is the general setup. So we're looking for an equation which is Lorentz invariant, involves the metric G mu nu and derivatives up to second order. This is somehow dimensional reasoning. So we collect basically all the Lego pieces we have at hand and then we build up what we can do. So now let's talk about derivatives. So now instead of this derivative, the Knappler operator or the gradient, yeah, we have to talk about now the derivative in space-time, which then has an index. Yeah, so we have derivatives also with respect to time. So this, instead of three components, now has four components. So here we have to talk about GR. We have then the covariant derivative So, and we can define the covariant derivative of a vector in the following way. So we have delta, but now with the index mu, okay, and a vector, and we give it a different index nu to be general. And then we argue, okay, there are two terms. So one term is just the ordinary derivative. And in principle, it can also depend on the field itself with some prefactor. And this prefactor we call gamma mu lambda. And this gamma are just the Christoffel symbols. Gamma, nu, nu, lambda. Christoffel symbols. And they are a measure of the curvature of space-time, right? So this term here would be the generalization in special relativity. And this term here is then an additional term which takes into account the curvature of space-time. Yeah? And we argue somehow that the derivative, the covariant derivative, should be proportional to the vector, which is the only four vector we have at hand, in addition to the spatial derivative. And we multiply it with a matrix, which we call gamma, and we map up the indices so that everything works out. So the lambda with the lambda contracts, so at the end of the day we have a mu down here and a nu up here. So this fits perfectly well the coefficient structure we have here in the whole equation. Yeah? So this has to be like this, basically. And one can define it actually like this, the covariant derivatives. And this d mu is the shorthand notation. So let's mark it like this. D mu stands for the partial derivative with respect to the coordinates, to the four coordinates, x mu, with upper index. Yeah, here comes an upper index, gives the lower index. If we take the derivative with an upper index, we get down a vector which has a lower index. And therefore, this object here has a lower index. Okay. Good. And there's also another shorthand notation that sometimes you see that the partial derivative of a four-vector can be defined as a four-vector and then with a comma here. Not a, yeah. And the covariant derivative sometimes is denoted also in a different way in various textbooks, where this is denoted as a colon, semicolon. So this is V mu semicolon of mu. Okay. Then, so this is more or less clear, I hope. Then we have to define what happens if we have a product of vectors.
How V dash mu, I can't read.
Dash, where's the dash?
D mu V mu is V.
This is a comma,
okay.
Mu, and this is a semicolon, mu.
Okay.
Yeah? That's just a shorthand notation. Okay, next we demand that the so-called Leibniz rule holds. The Leibniz rule tells you basically that we basically how to deal with the covariant derivatives of the product of vectors. Yes, and so delta kappa of for two vectors v mu w mu is equal covariant derivative of the first term times the second vector plus the first vector times the covariant derivative of the second one. Yeah? This is basically the product rule, Leibniz rule or product rule. Straightforward. This somehow looks clear that it has to be done that way, but we really have to mark that this is the case to fully specify this covariant derivative delta kappa or delta mu. Okay. Good. So how can we fix now the Christoffel symbols? That's the question. So how do we fix the Christoffel symbols? And we can fix them by making the following constraint. So gamma nu mu lambda is fixed by demanding that basically the covariant derivative of the metric tensor does not change. So delta kappa g mu nu is equal 0. Yeah. So we look at specific forms of the Christoffel symbol so that this relation is fulfilled. Now it's clear somehow why we are doing this. So whenever we have somehow the covariant derivative of a vector, with this constraint we can immediately switch to the one forms. Right? So we know the one forms are g mu nu times this one. And if the covariant derivative vanishes and the product rule holds, basically we can switch easily from one vector space to the other space. Because somehow the mixed term vanishes. Yeah, question.
Is this something like a fixer?
No, it's not a gauge fixing. It's not a gauge fixing.
What kind of fixation is this?
One calls this metric compatibility of the Christoffel symbols. So this is the metric compatibility.
So is this an additional constraint we pose, or is this something we can derive from general relativity theory?
No, we really have to demand it to get some explicit form of the Christoffel symbols. Yeah. So this means we can lower possible to raise and lower indices. Under the covariant derivative operator. This somehow is an operator, right? So it operates on vectors or product of vectors, and now we can just flip raise or lower indices because of the metric compatibility. It also fixes the Christoffel symbol. So we can write down what is going to happen if we look at the covariant derivative of this one. So this one, with upper indices, because we raise and lower with G mu nu, is the same as the one with lower indices, so this is zero. Yeah? But now we can apply the general rule we have up here for the covariant derivative. And we see, okay, so let's do it for the... Now we have to take care that we have two indices, so we can consider this one as a product of two vectors, basically. We can span this tensor with the two indices as a product of two vectors. Yeah, so somehow this looks like G mu nu. And we will see that we get two terms. So one term is where the covariant derivative acts on the first index, and the other one where it acts on the second index. Yeah. So we get the partial derivative first. That's the easy one, the kappa G mu nu. And then we work on the first index. So we get a gamma mu kappa lambda G lambda nu, and then on the second index. So this gives a gamma nu kappa lambda G mu lambda. Yeah? Okay. Yeah, and then we can shuffle around, shift up indices up and down and so on. But in principle, now it's clear, this is an equation which involves three quantities, the partial derivative, G mu nu, and the Christoffel symbols. So now we can solve for the Christoffel symbols and find a relation for the Christoffel symbols in terms of the partial derivative and the metric. And that's the standard solution you can find in any textbook on GR, how one can compute the Christoffel symbols from the metric and its first derivative. Now you can easily see the Christoffel symbols only depends on the metric. It can only depend on the metric itself and the first partial derivative of the metric tensor. So what you find then, if you solve this, gamma lambda mu nu is then equal a half G lambda kappa G kappa nu comma mu, our shorthand notation for the partial derivative, G kappa mu comma nu minus G mu nu kappa. Yeah, and in principle, you could easily convince yourself by plugging in this solution into this equation and using the properties of the symmetries of the metric tensor, you will see that this will give zero at the end. And so that's a unique solution, and these are the Christoffel symbols. Okay, shall I write down what this colon is? So G kappa, just to be clear, G mu nu kappa is defined as the partial derivative of mu nu with respect to dx kappa. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we note also that the Christoffel symbols are symmetric in the lower two indices. Yeah, because the partial derivatives commute and also the metric tensor is symmetric. So you find that gamma lambda mu nu is equal gamma lambda mu nu. And this is, in fact, this one defines really that the space-time is torsion-free. Torsion-free. Yeah, if there's torsion in the system, then somehow things change when you switch the coordinates. Yeah.
Is the upper index of the Christoffel symbol the first index, or do we not rotate it in the same position as the lower ones? Because we can, as I remember correctly, only write them on the same position as the index that they commute.
So the question was about the position of upper and lower indices, index. In fact, in GR, one can be quite sloppy. So basically, you mean if I put this index down, do I have to write it down here? Or can I put it down here and the other one up here? That was the question.
Especially in case of the Christoffersen loss.
Where
we have actually three indices.
Yeah. So we have, for the Christoffel symbols, we have three different indices. Now the question is the mu standing up on the lambda or the kappa? Is this the question, basically?
Yeah, or left on them, or right to them.
Or left and right, so that we have first the mu and then the kappa and the lambda. So in this case, in GR, somehow it doesn't really matter, because also of this torsion-free case, we can always swap the indices down here. In principle, if you look at the definition of all these operators and you define them as operators, it somehow tells you that basically the metric tensor maps a product of two vector to a scalar. Right? Basically, it's the norm of a vector. So I have g mu nu, v mu, v nu gives ds squared, and this is just the norm of the vector to a scalar. And then this mapping basically, when I take a vector and it's acting on the first index first, and then another vector which is acting on the second index first. In that sense, the order somehow is important. The order in the lower index is important because it defines which mapping is done first. Okay? And the same holds for the upper one because it's a different vector space. I multiply with one forms to make it a scalar. Yeah? Then the order also depends. Yeah.
What I do when I'm a system for maybe a rotating black hole, I cannot use that anymore. Then it's probably not torsion free. What I do then?
A black hole is not torsion free. No. This is
torsion means rotation or something. Or what does it mean?
No, it really means that space-time itself. So if there's no matter at all, you also find non-trivial solutions of space-time, and then you say the space-time somehow is not twisted. It's not twisted even in vacuum, so that when you have one vector here and one vector here and you just exchange it, suddenly you have something completely different. Or if you change just the coordinate system, you say I swap x and y basically, and I suddenly get a minus sign somewhere. So,
Other cases where there is torsion?
In GR, you usually assume that the space-time is torsion-free. There are extensions of GR where, for example, you include torsion, or more precisely, I was not precise in my statement of the last lecture, where you say that space-time is non-commutative. So basically, it depends. The vector product does not commute. So it depends whether you have vector 1 first times the other one or the other way around. So the product of two vectors suddenly is different. It means space-time is non-commutative. And people are discussing this as an extension of GR and possibly effects on black holes. Yeah, any more questions? Okay, so now we have discussed the first derivative. We have specified it fully. The first derivative looks like this one on the upper blackboard. And we have also defined now the Christoffel symbols. So the first derivative is defined. Now what about the second derivative? Yeah. So curvature of space-time we're looking actually at the second derivative. So we take a vector and take now the product of two covariant derivatives, delta mu, delta lambda, v kappa, minus delta lambda, delta mu, v kappa. And normally, if space-time would be not curved, it doesn't matter in which order I do this derivative. But if matter is curved, it actually depends basically which path I'm going to take through space-time. So do I first make the derivative in this direction and then in this direction? Or do it for in this direction and then in this direction? So this one should be proportional at the end. It's not zero, it should be proportional to the only quantity at hand we have here, besides covariant derivatives, and this is the vector itself. Okay. And now the same procedure applies as we did for the Christoffel symbols. We try to find a matrix which makes the whole thing work out. Okay, and let's denote this matrix with R. Okay, then what's the index here? So the index here we have is kappa. And the other index is mu and lambda. And then we have a nu down here also. So this is a mu, lambda, nu times this one. And now basically I've written it down in that way that the order now is given. So first we make the mapping with a one form, and then we make the mapping with a 3-4 vectors. Yeah? So I'll leave a space here. And you can imagine what this tensor is. Any idea what this tensor is?
Ricci. It's the Ricci tensor?
The Ricci tensor?
I think it's the Riemann tensor.
The Riemann tensor, right. So this
Ricci tensor is one projection that only has two indices.
Yeah. So this is the Riemann tensor. And if we know the Riemann tensor, we know basically the whole curvature of space-time. We know how basically vector fields are propagating through space-time. And you might have seen this famous example how to transport vectors in space-time. I'm sure you have seen this one, right? So if you go on the surface of Earth, so if you take a half plane of Earth, and now we do a parallel transport of a 4-vector, yeah, so we have a vector here which points, which is tangent to this point here, and then we move it up here and move it up here. So at the end it points in this direction. Now if you move in this direction here, so we do a parallel transport along this one, along this line, so it goes along here, here, and here. And then we do a parallel transport up here. Always we use the tangent. You see there will be a discrepancy in the 4 vectors at the point, depending on which path we are taking. So either this path here or this path here. All right, so.
How is a parallel motion defined in such a case?
Well, basically, you can think about a spare which you have back somewhere. You're transporting in the back in some cart, and you just walk along. And then the spare is always pointing in this direction you're moving. Now you do a parallel transport. Now for a cart, it's a little bit difficult. So you move sidewards first. But with your cart, the vector is still pointing in this direction, and then you go up to the North Pole, and then you find, okay, you're walking along this way, in this direction. That's what parallel transport means. Okay. So we were talking about the Ricci tensor. It turns actually out that the Riemann tensor, using all the symmetries we have by this definition, that it has 20 independent components. Yeah. So here, this is basically a parallel transport we're talking about here. Now we know that G mu nu, to define really the metric, you only need 10 independent components. So this basically has too many independent components. And we can actually contract this tensor so that it has the suitable amount of indices and a suitable amount of independent components to speak about it in a more practical way.
How do we get to 20 independent components? 5 components per...
This is a nice exercise for the GR course. Because it's really lengthy, yeah. But one can do it. Yeah. So maybe you can ask the tutors in the GR course, you want to derive why the Riemann tensor has only 20 independent components. But it takes some time. It's tedious. It's straightforward, so it takes a few pages of calculation. Okay. I'm thinking. Okay, so let's contract the whole thing and we come to the Ricci tensor. So we do what is called a contraction. Contraction basically means that we put the same index, the same upper and lower index on the Riemann tensor. So we sum over, basically, one upper and one lower index using the Einstein summation convention. And we define now the Ricci scalar by contracting the upper index with the second index. That's the standard choice. And that's now the Ricci tensor. Yeah, and we can do a further contraction. So R being defined as the contraction of the Ricci tensor is the Ricci scalar. Yeah, there are no indices left, so this must be a scalar or Lorentz invariant quantity. So there are cases where we have a simple curvature, which is described just by one scale. Then R, the Ricci scalar, describes basically the one and only overall curvature of space-time. Okay. So if you look now at the covariant derivative again, we rewrite a parallel transport using now the Ricci tensor by making the proper contraction. So we contract lambda and set lambda to be equal to kappa. Yeah, lambda equal to kappa. And we see that this equation boils down to the following equation. Delta mu delta lambda v lambda minus delta lambda delta mu v lambda is r mu nu times v with index nu. This is supposed to be a lambda. Okay? Good. And then we can also now, from this definition, we can plug in now the definition of the covariant derivatives, yeah, and solve for the Ricci tensor. The Ricci tensor then must be just a function of this double derivatives. Which means we have a product of this double derivatives, which means now if you go back to the definition of the double derivative of the covariant derivative, we will get second order derivatives, partial ones, the ordinary ones. And as a correction, we get now products of the Christoffel symbols. Yeah. And the rest basically drops out. So we get actually derivatives of the Christoffel symbol, if you map it up. So this is a gamma alpha mu alpha. Just the ordinary derivative minus gamma alpha mu nu. Ordinary derivative with respect to alpha minus a product of Christoffel symbols. Gamma alpha mu nu, gamma beta, alpha beta, plus gamma alpha mu beta, gamma beta nu alpha. Okay, so here we have the product of the Christoffel symbols and the first derivative of the Christoffel symbols, and you see the indices match up. Just by looking at indices, if we say, okay, R mu nu can only depend on the Christoffel symbols because it describes curvature, it can only depend on those two quantities. induce characteristic quantities. As you can also see, the partial derivatives drop out here. Why? Where's the d mu d nu here? Yeah?
In this funny comma notation, I think.
Yes, it's hidden here. So we have partial derivatives here, but in principle we could have d mu d nu, just the partial derivatives. And this is not here. So we, if you go back to the Christoffel symbols, this just depends on the first derivatives of g, but not on the partial derivative. So the partial derivative only acts on the metric tensor, but it doesn't appear freely. Yeah? Yes, they cancel out because we have defined it in this way that we are just sensitive to curvature. And if we go to flat space-time, of course, this one has to vanish. R mu has to vanish as we are in flat space-time. Yeah? And this is actually also the vacuum equation of Einstein. Yeah? So the vacuum equation simply means Einstein equation in vacuum. Just means R mu nu is equal to 0. Yeah? Good. And with this equation, this is a differential equation of up to second order, right? Here we have first order derivatives, a mixture of those, and here we have a product of two covariant derivatives, a product of two derivatives. So this is a second order differential equation. And R mu nu is symmetric, as you can convince yourself from the definition. And it has, therefore, 10 independent equations. Yeah, it's one simple equation, but of course it has 4 times 4, in principle, 16 equations. But due to symmetry arguments, only 10 are independent. Yeah? So we can fix all 10 components of the metric tensor by solving this equation. Now you would say, okay, this is zero, so one solution is, of course, g mu nu is equal to zero, but this is not the case. So there are actually solutions to this equation which are non-trivial in nature, and you might have heard about one of them. One solution. Yeah?
The Schwarzschild metric.
The Schwarzschild metric, right. So the Schwarzschild metric is a solution exactly of this equation, showing you in spherical symmetry a unique solution, which is stable, which was first found by Karl Schwarzschild a few months after Einstein equations appeared. In 1916, he wrote down the solution and sent it to Einstein. And Einstein was really surprised that it was possible to really solve this awkward differential equation. I mean, if you really write down all the components, you have 16 components. You have to map this to the metric tensor here. So this is, in principle, this is a total mess, right? So you have this product of those first derivatives. You have the derivative of the Christoffel symbol, so thereby the second derivative of the metric enters, and you have all these coefficients whirling around. But Schwarzschild managed. So Schwarzschild was not only a an astronomer. So he was actually the director of the observatory in Potsdam. So one tower is named after him. He's still in Potsdam. And he also was a mathematician because he had to observe the sky and calculate all the trajectories of things up in the sky, so he was also an excellent mathematician. So he managed to solve it and found a solution. Okay, any questions about Einstein equations in vacuum and a quick derivation? First ones, okay? If not, we will have a short break, and then in 15 minutes we start with the exercises in the same room. Yeah?